in the life of David. We're still in the first phase of David's life. David's life is maybe seen in three parts. The first part is that period of his life where he is a fugitive. He is anointed king, but nevertheless he is a fugitive from Saul. His life is on the line every day. The next period in his life is 2 Samuel, approximately the first 10 chapters, where Samuel or David is anointed publicly. He becomes Israel's king. Then from about chapter 10 of 2 Samuel all the way even up to the first part of 1 Kings, you have the third phase of David's life, his sin, Bathsheba, and the consequences that come out of this. So we're still in that first phase of his life, the time in which he was a fugitive. One of the important values of studying the life of David is that it provides us with background to the Psalms. You cannot really appreciate the Psalms unless you understand something of the life of David. So there are some benefits, there are more benefits than one in studying the life of David, is that when we study his life in the three parts that I just mentioned, you can see that a number of the Psalms fit into these three phases of his life. We will do that tonight because we're going to study a phase of David's experience, which we find him going from a condition of obedience and joy in the Lord to a time of depression. You and I, sometime or another, you have had a bout with depression. It's probably more easily described than defined. It's that downness that you get into, that blue feeling. There is a loss of zest for life. There is suddenly the desire to do all those things that you'd once looked at with in keen anticipation. Somehow now when you look at them, it's just a mountain of work. You find yourself not wanting to do much of anything. You find yourself actually being a little anxious. Maybe anxious about something that you're not even sure of. You just do not feel as if you do not have a sense of spiritual well-being. David faced experiences like this, and one of the values in studying the Psalms is that you can go from the Psalms back to the historical books and you can find where David, what gave the occasion for depression and how to handle it. So tonight we're going to look in chapters 26 and 27 of 1 Samuel, David's depression. This 26th chapter is really background to David's depression. Let's pray before we study it. Our Father, we meet together out of obedience to you. You've told us that we should not forsake the assembling of ourselves together, but we should meet together out of desire to honor you, to praise you, to know one another better so that we may lift up our needs in prayer together. Use this time tonight to so develop our thoughts after your thoughts and that our ways may be conformed to your ways. And as we study this matter of depression and what brings it on, may we be very honest with ourselves. May we be taught of you. And may we not allow depression to rob us of that joy that you want to give us daily in Christ. We ask it in his name. Amen. The 26th chapter of 1 Samuel is the background to David's depression. There is no depression in the 26th chapter. It is really one of the highlights of David's life in that we see him rather magnificent in this chapter. But David was under tremendous pressure, and you can see that from what occurs in this section. Verse 1, 1 Samuel 26. Then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, Is not David hiding on the hill of Hakilah, which is before Jeshimon? So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, and having with him 3,000 chosen men of Israel, to search for David in the wilderness of Ziph. The area that is mentioned here, the wilderness of Ziph, most of the events in this part of David's life occur on a line. If I drew it across the map from the city of Ashdod over on the coast, east over to the Dead Sea, slightly south of Jerusalem, most of the events in this first phase of David's life while he was a fugitive occur in this area to the south, around Hebron, down toward Beersheba. The wilderness of Ziph is between Hebron and the Dead Sea. It is an area that David resorted to. It offered many hiding places, caves, good vantage points, cliffs, areas where he could quickly move about. He would know it like the back of his hand, and the pursued was always an advantage over the pursuer. This is the area where it is taking place. The Ziphites are people who inhabit this area, and they become informers. They go to Saul, and they tell him of David's whereabouts. They have seen David's campfires. They've spotted David. They go to Saul, and now Saul pursues David. But David has his own reconnaissance. He becomes aware when Saul steps into this area. It says that Saul camped in the hill of Hakilah, which is before Jeshimon, beside the road. And David was staying in the wilderness. And when he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies, and he knew that Saul was definitely coming. David then arose and came to the place where Saul had camped. And David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner the son of Ner, the commander of his army. And Saul was lying in the circle of the camp, and the people were camped around him. Now the writer here is simply setting the scene in these first few verses to show us something that's really the central point. And that is David coming into the camp while Saul and all his men are asleep. And David has a perfect opportunity to kill Saul. That is suggested to him by his colleague Abishai. David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, saying, "Who will go down with me to Saul in the camp?" Now that was quite a request to make. It's like having all the men lined up, and who would like to volunteer to go in a mission that may cost you your life? Well, Abishai spoke up immediately and said, "I will go down with you." Now, you might want to keep a note, a mental record of Abishai. He's going to be quite prominent in the life of David. He's going to be one of David's most trusted servants through the years to come. He's going to later save David's life in the Philistine Wars. He is going to be faithful to David up to the very end. Even during the rebellion of Absalom, Abishai is going to be right by David's side. So you can see his bravery immediately evidenced here, that he's willing to go with David into the very jaws of the enemy. So David and Abishai came to the people by night. Everybody's asleep. Saul was sleeping in the circle of the camp. And he had the spear stuck in the ground at his head. And Abner and the people were lying around him. Of course, they were asleep too. The spear stuck right at the head of Saul was more than just a convenient place to put your weapon so that you could easily get your hand on it if you were aroused in the middle of the night. It is rather strange that they don't have sentries on duty. You would think they would, but they don't apparently. But this spear stuck right at the head of where Saul is sleeping. This was a symbol of his authority. You recall when he sat on his throne and David would play the harp for him that he would have the spear in his hand. It was a sign of authority. It was like the scepter. He had the spear instead of the scepter. Then Abishai said to David, "They've slipped into camp. It's quiet. It's dark. Today has delivered your enemy into your hand. Now therefore, please, let me strike him with the spear." The same spear that Saul had taken on more than one occasion and had hurled at David to try to pin him to the wall. Abishai is saying, "All right, now here's your chance to take that very spear and spear him. And you could, with one stroke, you could kill him." But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, For who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt? Now, David demonstrates some extraordinary qualities here, some very good thinking. Number one, he recognizes that Saul is God's anointed, and as long as Saul is alive, it is not David's prerogative to take Saul's life. That is God's doing. He will not lay his hand upon him to take his life. Assassination also would be a very bad precedent, wouldn't it? He can assassinate Saul. David certainly wouldn't want to become king on that kind of a note. You and I are familiar with this happening in all kinds of countries where coups take place, a palace coup. Those in charge are taken by force and herded out before a firing squad, then the next group to come along, they do the same thing. Well, David doesn't want to set that kind of precedent. Verse 11, he says that, verse 10, as the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, and his day will come that he dies, or he will go down into battle and perish. So David is absolutely convinced that God is sovereign and that God will take Saul in his own time. He does not really need to resort to murder. David apparently has learned something from the Nabal experience. What was David going to do with Nabal? David was about to take Nabal and pin him to the wall, kill Nabal and his men, but he was stopped by Abigail. So I take it that David has learned something from that experience, and now he's not willing to take things into his own hands. He views it and puts it in perspective that God will take care of demoting Saul in his own time. He doesn't need to lift a hand to do it. This is patience. This is spiritual insight. I think it's a very high point, a great high point in David's life. But David did this. He says, so David took the spear and the jug of water from beside Saul's head, and they went away. They went a little ways outside the camp. The writer inserts here for us the fact that there was a deep sleep that came upon Saul. Apparently David didn't know about this. This was something that God was doing in his providence. If the Hebrew word for this phrase, deep sound sleep, in verse 12, the Hebrew is tardema. It occurs in two other places outside of this passage. This is the kind of sleep that God put upon Adam when he took the rib out of Adam and made Eve. This is the sleep that came over Abram when God gave him that extraordinary experience of the sealing and the signing of the covenant with him. So God had, in his providence, had protected David by putting this unusual sleep over Saul and his men. Well, David went out across the way, and he then began to yell out, and this aroused the men, and David, and or Saul, and his colleague Abner hear David. And David says, "Are you not a man?" He really chides Abner here. There's going to be some interesting give and take in the future between David and Abner, but David chides Abner at this point, and he says to him, "Now this thing you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, all of you must surely die because you did not guard your Lord." Now Saul recognized David's voice, and he responds, and he said, "Why then is my Lord pursuing his servant? For what have I done?" This is David speaking to Saul. What evil is in my hand? David wants Saul to understand that he has not. He could have killed him if he had wanted, but he doesn't have any axe to grind with Saul. He wants Saul to realize that he is not out to kill him. And then why should Saul be pursuing him? That's the point that he's tried to make with Saul again and again and again. Now you say, well then why does Saul relentlessly pursue David? He seems to come upon him and almost catch him, and then David will say something to him, and then Saul says back, "Well, I'm sorry, I've done it, I know this is wrong." But then Saul is persistent in his pursuit of David, even in spite of what David says and declaring his innocence. The reason is that there were those who were in Saul's court and who were very close to Saul, who were bitter enemies of David. They wanted to kill David. Now, you can understand that from just the political standpoint, can't you? That those who were close to Saul were Benjamites, many of them. And if David comes into power and he becomes the king, then this is going to mean the end of their power, of their influence. They're going to have to leave. When one administration leaves, the cabinet leaves. And these men are not willing to let their power slip from them. And they are always hatching some kind of conspiracy. I think that they probably prodded Saul intensely. and spread rumors about David. You see this in the Psalms quite frequently, where David refers to his enemies and those who spread rumors about him and who lie about him. And Cush the Benjamite and Doeg the Edomite and these men and others like them were spreading these rumors and were conniving and stirring up Saul and getting him to go after David, to kill David. And that is in the background of these statements. And now verse 19, very interesting statements in 19 and 20. We're still getting the background to David's depression, so I'm building you up for that, so be ready for it. Now therefore, please let my lord the king listen to the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. Well, David says, if I have done wrong, I am willing to go to the sanctuary and make an offering and atone for my sins. I'm perfectly willing to do this. If I have wronged you, I will take care of that wrong. But if it is the men, cursed are they. They should be judged before the Lord, for they have driven me out today that I should have no attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go, serve other gods. Now then, do not let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to search for a single flea, just as one hunts a partridge in the mountains. Well, let's come back to David's statement, though, about this leaving the presence of the Lord. Now, that's an interesting statement. Look in verse 19. He says, to drive me out and make me serve other gods. Critics of the Bible have taken this statement by David, and they have seized upon it to say, well, there, that shows you that David believed in Yahweh as just a tribal god. The critics of the Bible, many of them believe in they take the evolutionary theory and they impose it on the scriptures, and they make it appear as if Israel believed in beginning with many gods, and then they've come down to believe in one God. And that this is simply another evidence of the fact, more evidence, that David was like many others. They believed Yahweh was their own tribal God, and to leave the land was to leave the God, their God, and he would have to go serve another God in another land. But that really misses the point. And this is the point because certainly we know that David did not believe that about Yahweh. Look in Psalm in chapter 8 and verse 9, for instance. Let's see just a statement or two about what David did think about the Lord. But try to understand the phrase, what he means when he says, to leave, do not let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord. He speaks as if being outside the land is going to be away from the Lord. How can that be? I want to show you. But I want to show you what he did believe about the Lord. In Psalm 8 and verse 9, he says, O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is thy name where? In all the earth. Now that's just representative of a whole host of passages that demonstrate that David looked at Yahweh as the God of all the universe, of all the earth. He was not some tribal deity. He was not some God that they had only in Israel, and then when they left Israel, you have to adopt a new God. This was the God of all the earth. In Psalm 18 and in verse 49, he says something comparable to this. He says, therefore, I give thanks to thee among the nations, O Lord. I will sing praises to thy name, that you are the God of all, not just Israel, of all the nations. Well, you see that theme constantly in the Psalms. But what David is actually saying here is he is speaking as an Old Testament believer under the theocracy. And David, if he had been banished from the land, what would he have left? He would have left the tabernacle. He would have left the sanctuary of the Lord, in which there was the showbread, the lampstand, the altar of incense, the altar of sacrifice, the Ark of the Covenant, and the priest in his flowing white garments and across his forehead, holiness unto the Lord, and the bells tinkling at the hems of his garment, and the smell of the sacrifices. See, God built into Israel's entire worship. It was more sensual. I don't mean that in the way we might associate with it, evil, but God taught Israel through the senses. When you experienced worship in Israel around the tabernacle, it was through sight, it was through smell, it was through hearing. And this order and worship, the sacrifices, the priest, to be out of the land, you were cut off from all that. See? you were cut off from the presence of God, in that you were cut off from this worship, from the sacrifices, from the temple. You were cut off, for all practical purposes, from the presence of the Lord. Now, when he says that he was then to, if he had been driven from the land, he would be forced out into other gods, what he is saying then, he would be, this would be a great spiritual loss for David. Would that he had remembered this when we get down to verse 1 of chapter 27, he seems to forget it. But this would be a great spiritual loss for David to leave the land and the worship of the Lord in the sanctuary, which was a very important part of his life and any Jew's life. And that this loss would be like leaving the presence of the Lord and being thrust out into the presence of false gods. For the nations around them all worship the false gods. He goes down to Philistia soon, and we'll go to where the god Dagon and other false gods are worshipped. And so he will leave all of his order and worship and the priesthood, and he will be thrust out into these heathen societies where they worship false gods, and there isn't that recognition of the holiness of Yahweh. For a Jew to be thrust from the land, that was the sure sign of the loss of God's blessing. That was what was so tragic about the exile. For Israel to be believed to be exiled from the land, that was the sign of God's disfavor. That was the ultimate chastisement. This is why capital punishment was such a severe thing for the Jew. Not that he knew so much about the afterlife that he feared that, but that he would be blotted out of the land of the living. And no longer could he be associated with the temple and the worship of the Lord in that sense. It's hard for us to understand that because, see, in the church age, our dispensational worship is different, isn't it? We don't worship in those externals like the Jew did. We don't speak of a place as where God is like they would have at the tabernacle. Now, some Christians do, but they're just because they're poorly taught. We don't speak of the house of God. At least we're not supposed to. There is no house of God in a building. Your body is the temple of the Spirit if you're a believer. But there is no house of God. We don't go through these externals. We don't have to go through priests. We are priests. And the sacrifice is the praise of our lips to the Lord. So what is the comparison then? Well, for us today, it's like being thrust out from the presence of the Lord, leaving the presence of the Lord in terms of fellowship, losing the joy of your fellowship with the Lord, losing the joy of fellowship with fellow believers, and being thrust out in a heathen world, like excommunication from the local church in 1 Corinthians, put out into the domain of Satan, as it were, cannot fellowship with Christians, cannot participate in the communion service, cut off from all that. That would be the comparison. And so this is why David looks upon this as an awful thing, to be driven out from the presence of the Lord. Then he says something else about Saul's pursuit, though. He adds that, why are you searching for me for a single flea? We talked about that previously, but he adds the phrase, just as one hunts a partridge in the mountains. What is there about hunting a partridge in the mountains? Anybody ever hunted a partridge in the mountains? I don't think anyone's here has ever hunted a partridge like they hunt them in Palestine. The kind of partridge that's mentioned here, that he's referring to, runs from its pursuer, not by moving its wings and flying away, but by just running across the ground. And so if you wanted to catch a partridge, you would just chase and chase and chase and chase. Finally, you would get it so fatigued and tired, you'd take sticks. You'd have a few sticks, and you would just fling it along the ground, and that bird was so tired, all it took was just like knocking the props right out from under them, and that bird, right over on the ground. David is saying this is what it's like. You're chasing me, but I'm in the mountains. This partridge in the mountains. You wouldn't have hunted a partridge in the mountains. One little partridge chasing all over the hills, in caves, up cliffs. No, you would be better off down in the flatlands where you can find coveys of them. But what David is reminding Saul, why are you chasing me? And here David had the opportunity to kill Saul, and he didn't do it. Saul responds, do you believe Saul's sincerity? It's hard to believe. I've sinned, he said. Return my sin, David, for I will not harm you again, because my life was precious in your sight this day. You saved my life. David, let's let bygones be bygones. I played the fool and have committed a serious error. I wish I could believe Saul. I don't believe him because David didn't believe him. And here I think Saul is so far gone. He sees what he ought to do. I guess you could say there's never such thing as a conscience that's so completely ruined that they never realize what they ought to do. We always realize what we ought to do, but Saul can't because he's ruined himself spiritually. So David responds, and as we move on down into verse 24 and 25, he said, "Now behold, as your life was highly valued in my sight this day, so may my life be highly valued in the sight of the Lord." Then Saul said to David, "Blessed are you, my son David. You will both accomplish much and surely prevail." So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. Now that is the background for David's depression. David's not depressed here, don't get me wrong, but he's under tremendous pressure. I want you to see that. We've seen in the previous chapters the fact that he's a fugitive, Samuel is dead, his spiritual confidant. You know, that's difficult when you lose someone close to you than one you could confide, lean upon. Samuel is dead. Conspiracies are constantly being worked out by Saul and his men against David. Many around Saul were bitterly hostile to David. David has a family and 600 men to look out for and to see that they have provisions. He's in constant fear of violent death. All of these things, that's pressure. Now, David responds magnificently to it. I'm going to show you later on in Psalm 57 how he did handle it. But here's David. He is, though, a candidate for depression if he does not handle these pressures correctly. Well, let's go a little further. David is going to succumb to these pressures. And in will come some depression. The constant threat of death, he seems to come to a breaking point. It's interesting the way depression often comes. You can go on with the pressures and you're rejoicing in the Lord and the joy of the Lord's in your heart and you have a zest for life, and even though the pressures are great, God's working in your heart and you've got it all in perspective. The fruit of the Spirit is being born, but then all of a sudden, bang, all of that adversity now, rather than being looked upon as the means of blessing in your life, suddenly becomes in your sight simply adversity. And you look at it completely different. It's like rather than being on the inside looking out, now you're on the outside looking in. You have a completely different perspective. And what was really great pressure, but yet you rejoiced in the Lord in the midst of it. The pressure is there still, but you're not rejoicing now. What happens? Verse 1 of chapter 27, David's bout with depression. David thought to himself, "Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul." Be destroyed, it should be translated. I'll be destroyed by Saul. David, where is your confidence in the promises of God? Don't you know that God has anointed you to be king? God had even used Abigail to remind David that he would not be slain. Do you remember what she said to him? If you look back in chapter 25, and it wasn't too far in the past either. When she says to him in chapter 25, verse 29, says, "Then the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling." That was truth. Abigail was giving David doctrinal principles for him to reckon, count on. He already knew it. But now what do we see him say? "I will perish one day by the hand of Saul." David has just succumbed to depression. He steps into depression. And here is the trigger mechanism that would lead to David's depression. Disobedience to the revealed will of God triggers the depression mechanism. And it's going to be difficult for David. And there are all kinds of repercussions that come from this. But what's the first step in David's bout with depression? What brought it on? The first thing was that David doubted the promises of God. David had the promises of God that he would be king, but now he doubts those promises. your steps and look and see if you're not doubting some promise of God. Somewhere along the line. Are you claiming the promises of God and living by those promises? He says, one day I will be destroyed by the hand of Saul. David, there is no way in the world you'll be destroyed by Saul's hand. God has given you this promise. What are you doing? What David is doing is succumbing, and he's going to become depressed. Well, by the way, do you and I have any pressures? Now, you and I aren't pursued by Saul, but we're pursued by the world, the flesh, and the devil every day. And those pressures come in all assortments and sizes. And I guess if you were to sit down and write out the pressures that are there with you, around you, in you, you might be tempted like David is here. But David devised a plan. See, he does wrongly when he's faced with this problem. This is the sure way to go in on into depression. He devised a plan to relieve the pressure. He decides he's going to leave the land, the very thing that he shouldn't do. He devises a plan, and this took him out into the presence of these idolaters. And here's the plan. He goes down to a place called Gath, out in Philistia, in the domain of his enemies. Gath, if you notice here where I'm pointed toward Hebron, if you were to go out to the west and slightly to the north, you'll come to the city of Gath. And he goes over to Gath, and David lived with Achish at Gath. He and his men, each with his household. But Saul therefore stopped pursuing David. Then David said to Achish, "If now I have found favor in your sight, let them give me a place in one of the cities in the country." So David is wrong for having gone out of the land, but at least he's trying to do something right when he's gone. He wants a city all his own, a place called Ziklag. Ziklag is further to the south. Here is Gath up here. You come down south approximately 20 miles, about 12 miles north and west of Beersheba. You come to the city of Ziklag. This is where David and his family and his 600 men are going to live. David wants Achish to think this, and David enters into a devised plan of deception here. He wants Achish to think that he is going out on these raids and actually attacking fellow Israelites. But what he's actually doing is not killing them, but killing the enemies of Israel. You see what he does. He's there for a year and 4 months doing this. Verse 8, David and his men went up and they raided the Geshurites, the Girzites, the Amalekites, for they were the inhabitants of the land from ancient times. As you come up to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt, all these places are down toward the Negev, to the south of the land, down in this area here, south of Hebron, down near Beersheba and further south. So he goes out on these raids. But when he goes out with a heavy hand. David attacked the land and did not leave a man or a woman alive, and he took away the sheep, the cattle, the donkeys, the camels, and the clothing. I mean, he has to have provisions for his 600 men. Then he returned and came to Achish. The reason David was doing this extermination is that he couldn't leave anybody alive to get word back to Achish what he was really doing. Achish thought that he was, this was a feather in Achish's cap, so Achish thought. Yeah, he'd like to have David down here, let David fight his battles for it. He knew that there had been a fallout between him and Saul, and therefore a rift in Israel, and this would be to the advantage of the Philistine, Achish. So he thought David was really working on his behalf. He'd be glad to have these mercenaries in there fighting his wars for him. David leads him to think that, but David is actually going on and taking on these enemies of Israel. But it's deception on David's part. And Achish said, "Where have you made a raid today?" Then David answers him with all the places mentioned in verse 10. David did not leave a man. Here's the explanation, though, of what really David was doing. He did not leave a man or a woman alive to bring to Gath, saying, "Lest they should tell about us, saying, so has David done, and so has been his practice all the time he lived in the country of the Philistines." For a year and 4 months, he had fooled Achish. And he'd actually been fighting the enemies of Israel. So Achish believed, or he trusted David, saying, "He has surely made himself odious among his people Israel. Therefore he will become my servant forever." Achish thought he had him in the palm of his hand, but David deceived him. Now God's going to overrule this. In God's providence, he overrules this, and these exploits of David while in Philistia become an advantage. When David becomes king of Israel, he will know the geography of Philistia. He will know battle tactics well, and that will help him as king. God overruled and worked in his providence, but that doesn't justify what David did. Do you see David's beginning of a low point in his life? I think David was definitely depressed here. I want to take you to a couple of Psalms. I want to take you, before I get to Psalm 57, by Psalm 13. You see this kind of thing in David's Psalms frequently. I can give you one in Psalm 10 in verse 1. Here is David in a fit of depression. We don't know exactly when Psalm 10 was written. Probably, I think, is very good reason to believe it was at this time in his life when he is thinking that he would die by the hand of Saul. Look what David said, Psalm 10, 1. "Why dost thou stand afar off, O Lord? Why dost thou hide thyself in times of trouble? In pride the wicked hotly pursues the afflicted. Who's the afflicted? David. He was being hotly pursued by Saul and his men. In pride the wicked hotly pursues the afflicted. Let them be caught in the plots which they have devised." Now look in Psalm 13. "How long, O Lord, wilt thou forget me forever?" Have you ever felt like God's forgotten you? That's the way you feel when you go into depression. You feel like God has forgotten you. "And how long wilt thou hide thy face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart all the day? How long will my enemy be exalted over me?" You see, his problem in depression, you're looking at the dark side of the moon. Everything looks bleak. It looks like God has abandoned you. Everything's working against you. You've lost perspective on all the problems that you face. The pressures are overwhelming. And it looks like it's not going to get better, but worse. That's depression. How do you get out of that? How do you handle it? I want to give you as an example Psalm 57. This psalm was written at David's, somewhere along the line, when David was hiding in a cave, being pursued by Saul. I think the superscription here is though not inspired, but yet I think it has some good tradition and quite helpful. "A miktam of David when he fled from Saul in the cave," which was at the cave in Adullam and Gedi, one of those caves. This should have been David's psalm in 1 Samuel 27:1. It was his psalm in 1 Samuel 26. It was his psalm in 1 Samuel 24. It was his psalm in 1 Samuel 22. Here is my remedy, not mine, but the one I recommend to you, for depression. Look at this psalm as a remedy for depression. Here's the proper response to depression. When you are faced with overwhelming pressure and you can't see the end, the light at the end of the tunnel, the pressure is there and it's mounting, here's the psalm for you. I want you to see that there are at least four very important principles that come out of this psalm in dealing with depression. How not to even get in it. The psalm is divided into two parts, verses 1 to 6 and verses 7 to 11. Verses 1 to 6 is a prayer. You will notice that in both parts of the psalm, there is a refrain, and it's the key to the entire psalm. It's a key fact in handling depression. Verse 5 and verse 11, you'll see that refrain. "Be exalted above the heavens, O God, and let thy glory be above all the earth." Verse 11. "Be exalted above the heavens, O God, let thy glory be above all the earth." And we'll come back to that, but that's important. Now look at David's statements here in the view of the fact that he's hiding in a cave. Here is Saul with his 3,000 men. You know, a cave can not only be a place of hiding, it could also be a trap. When you're in a cave, you're either well hidden or well trapped. No way out, but one way. Look what David says, though. This is the way you should behave in the pressures. Not the way he did in 1 Samuel 27:1. Surely Saul will kill me. But this, be gracious to me, O God. Be gracious to me. This, let your favor be upon me. You do what's right for me, O God. He uses the name for God, Elohim. God who is all-powerful and who can provide all that he needs. He says, for my soul takes refuge in thee, and in the shadow of thy wings I will take refuge until destruction passes by. David can probably hear his heartbeat in the darkness. Hears the voices outside the cave of Saul's men moving on by. And his mouth is dry from fear. But this is what's going through his mind. He wrote it at that time. And he's saying, men would look upon that cave as the refuge. But you know what David said was the refuge? It was not that cave that was his refuge. It was God that was his refuge. It was God who was working sovereignly to protect him with that very earthy thing, a cave. God uses certain material things to protect and provide for his children in the time of adversity. Men would look at this as simply a cave, which is a good hiding place. David said, God, you are my refuge. This cave would be a trap if it were not for God. But with God, it's a hiding place. That's the refuge. David says further, in the shadow of thy wings I will take refuge. This is the poetic way, beautiful way, describing God's mothering of David. Like the bird, the wings are for the purpose of flight, locomotion, and for protection. And he sees here God is likened unto this hen who would gather him under his wings and would protect him and cover him. He says, until the disaster has passed. The word here in the Hebrew for disaster, the word is hawa. And hawa means can mean a chasm. Something that just actually engulfs you. And David is describing, this is probably a very beautiful way to describe that cave. It's something that he's engulfed in. It almost could be a trap. But he's saying that this engulfing ruin that faces me, this great pressure, he is saying that God will protect me till this great disaster passes by. In the midst of it, he's absolutely sure that God's going to protect him. Then he says, I will cry to Elohim Elyon. El Elyon. He looks to God as the all-powerful, most high, sovereign God, who therefore has his hands on everything and controls all of the affairs around him. So, listen, this is good tonic for depression. For when you're depressed, you aren't thinking like that. You're thinking that God is in control of all these things. He will not allow anything to hurt me and touch me. He will do what's best for me. That's the way David is thinking. He says, to God who accomplishes all things for me, that is, fulfills his purpose. This is Philippians 4:19. My God shall supply all your need according to his riches and glory. This is David's Philippians 4:19. So this is God's power to help him, God's ability to come forth and provide for all of David's need. Are you seeing the first step in the proper response to depression? You know what the first step is? I'm going to wait and give you that. Let's go on through the psalm. He says, he will send from heaven and save me. See, he's God, is El Elyon, the God who is transcendent and above all the earth. But he's not so transcendent that he cannot be immanent. That is, come down and do what needs to be done. He will extend help because he controls all the affairs of men. He's not remote, so remote that he cannot come in and do what's necessary for you. He says, he reproaches him who tramples upon me, those who are in hot pursuit. God will send forth, and he personifies this. It's almost as if these are angelic messengers who are coming with flaming swords and with all kinds of provision. But rather than flaming messengers, what are they? His loving kindness and his truth. You'll notice that he mentions these two in verse 10, his loving kindness and truth. You cannot read the Psalms without confronting loving kindness. The tragedy in the translation that you have before you, if it's a New American Standard, is that loving kindness is not a good translation. Not a good translation at all of the word. The Hebrew word here, and let's linger on it just a minute, it's an important word in the Psaltery. David is constantly referring to it. It is this word in the Hebrew. It is chesed. Chesed. Chesed is God's love for those that he is covenanted with. It is describing a covenant love, a loyal love, that of a husband for a wife and a wife for a husband. They've entered into a covenant. Therefore, there is to be loyal love. Not just love, but loyal love. That is, God will be loyal because he's entered into a special relationship. Chesed. The Hebrews had observed in nature, in the stork, they observed in the stork something very interesting. They called the stork the Kasidah. The Kasidah, and it's taken from this root Chesed, the Kasidah was the Hebrew word for stork. And the stork is in contrast to, say, that bird, the ostrich. The ostrich would lay its eggs under the sand and would go away, leaving it for some heavy foot to come along and squash, scramble eggs instead of young ostriches. But the stork is not like that. The stork is very loyal and loving for its young. And, by the way, that's where we get this old idea. How did you get here? The stork brought you. Why did that ever come about? Because the stork historically has been seen, observed, as a bird that very loyal to its young, caring. And the Hebrews saw this in nature, and they called the stork the Chasidah. Because, see, the root here is chesed. It's loyal love. And David looks at God, and what's he holding on to as he goes through these pressures? He's holding on to the chesed, this loving kindness of God, the loyal love of God. God is going to be true to David because God has entered into a relationship with David, and David doesn't doubt it. That's what he holds on when he goes around the curves, when he goes down the hills, when he goes through the dark spots. He's holding on to chesed, God's loyal love, and God's truth or faithfulness. God will keep his word. My soul is among lions, he says. I must lie among those who breathe forth fire, fire of hatred, like Doeg the Edomite, Cush the Benjamite. Even the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows, their tongue a sharp sword. They had insulting things to say of David. They had conspiracies they're always working on. They maligned David. They lied about him. They slandered him. Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let thy glory be above all the earth. David says a magnificent thing here. This is not a prayer for God to be glorified. This is praise that God will be glorified. Do you know what David is saying here? It's a key fact in this matter, proper approach to depression. David sees that there is something more important than his immediate needs. David sees the most important thing is for God to be glorified, and therefore it may be necessary for you to be under great pressure. The most important thing is not how many pressures you and I have to face, but is God getting glory to himself. That puts it in perspective. That is the Lord's Prayer, isn't it? Hallowed be thy name. That's the very thought. David says, he puts his problems and pressures right in perspective with this. Oh, that he would have thought this way in 1 Samuel 27:1. That our pressures are inconsequential to what greater issue? Is God getting the glory in what he is calling me into in this time of my life? That's the great issue. That'll keep you from self-pity. You know what self-pity is? See, self-pity is just inward. It's so self-oriented toward me. Thinking about my problems, occupied with these. But David looks out and sees God's glory to be done over all the earth. He says, they have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They dug a pit before me. They themselves have fallen into the midst of it. Selah. You know, Selah. Can't translate it, so we just have to say Selah. You know, this was a song. This was to have been sung, and these Selahs were, they were a way of when they would come to this part, they would let out a great shout of joy. It's a little bit like trying to translate hip hip hooray. What can you how you translate that? It was just the joyous way of exalting in God and who He was. Then in 7 to 11, breaks into praise. He breaks into praise. He says, "My heart is steadfast." Now this is not chesed here. This is a word which simply means stability. It's used elsewhere in the Old Testament of a house that's set upon pillars, a house that has a good foundation. It means to be established and fixed. And when he says his heart, he's speaking of his attitudes, his mind. And see, this is the way he should have been rather than depressed. And when you're not depressed, you are stabilized. And he's saying that my thoughts are right here. God, you have given me equilibrium. You've given me perspective. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing. Yes, I will sing praises. This music has profound effect upon us, and that's the way the Psaltery was. And that what this is saying is that David is breaking forth into great thanksgiving publicly for his God for delivering him. I will sing praises. Awake my glory. Awake harp and lyre. I will awaken the dawn. David poetically describes the situation this way. Usually it's the dawn that awakens us, isn't it? But David says, I'm going to wake up the dawn. I am going to get up exalting. Look, when you can get up exalting, you're not in depression. When you can get up in the dark hours of the morning and look at the day, and you can begin it with praise to God and thanksgiving to Him, you're not depressed. He says, for thy loving kindness, he explains why he can get up before the daylight and praise God. For thy loving kindness is great to the heavens, thy truth to the clouds. Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let thy glory be above all the earth. Here again, David has his problems in perspective. His pressures are inconsequential compared to the glory of God. Now let me take you back through those four things that I see are essential if you're going to have the proper response to depressing situations. The first is this. You pray for enlightenment. You ask for help. If you are depressed, you know what you need to do? The first thing, you go into God's presence. You force yourself into God's presence. Don't sit around and wait till you feel like praying. You go into God's presence, and maybe all you can say is, oh God, help me. I don't know why I'm depressed, or you may know why, but you don't want to do anything about it. But you go into God's presence, you ask for enlightenment, you ask for understanding, you ask for wisdom. And that is the proper meaning, context of James 1:7. When we ask for wisdom, that verse is often taken out of context. But the point of it is that when we are in adversity and suffering, we look to God and ask God for enlightenment as to our suffering. That is when we ask God for wisdom, and He'll give it to us liberally. He will not make us feel bad for asking it. He will give us insight into these problems. He'll give you insight as to your needs, your depression. He'll give you understanding. Force yourself into His presence. Pray for enlightenment. Secondly, ponder God's promises. Ponder God's promises. He says, for instance, that you are my refuge until the destruction passes by. You might be going through what could be a counterpart, your counterpart till the destruction passes by. You're being buffeted by one wave after another. But you are holding on to God till that destruction passes by. So you ponder the promises of God. You think upon them. You read them. You memorize them. You meditate upon them. The third fact that you need to do, what you need to engage in, is that you must not allow the pressures to drive you away from God. Don't allow the pressures to drive you away from God. That's the worst thing that could happen. But let the pressures drive you to the Lord. It's one of the beautiful things about the Psalms, and I believe that is probably why you have found refuge in them, like I have on times, is that you see the Psalm is the person speaking to God. You say, Lord, you've abandoned me. You've left me. But then he comes back around and he says what he does. I had you in Psalm 13. You don't need to turn to it. But look how he breaks out of that situation. He breaks out of the darkness and comes out into the daylight. And he says this on in the middle of the Psalm 13. He said, how long? He begins, how long, O Lord? And then he says, consider and answer me and lighten mine eyes. Then he look in verse 5 of Psalm 13. He says, but I have trusted in thy loving kindness. See, he breaks out of it. So you do not allow the pressures to drive you away from God. Don't engage in self-pity. Don't start welling up with resentment, bitterness, trying to put the blame on somebody else. A fourth fact, a fourth means of dealing with this depression is trust God's good providence to work on your behalf. Trust God's good providence to work on your behalf. What do I mean? You know, you may have been disobeyed the Lord, and now you're depressed, and all kinds of things have come, all kinds of consequences have come as a result of that. You did wrong, and you have sowed some seed that's coming back. The chickens are coming home to roost. But what are you going to do? That can be the occasion for more depression, something that feeds depression. What do you do after the things have been done that are wrong? You trust God's good providence to overrule the wrong. I see that in David's experience in 1 Samuel 27. David went down to Gath and then to Ziklag, and he deceived Achish for 1 year and 4 months. Did God overrule that? He did. It later turned out that David used that knowledge that he gained in that year and 4 months as an advantage. God can take that the evil that is done and bring it about for his good. That's no license for doing the evil. It will leave its marks. But God is great enough to overrule. Don't you get depressed about the things that you've done wrong. You deal with them according to the Scripture, and you allow God's good providence to overrule. You can't go back and redo those things. You cannot go back and make that decision over. You can't call back those words. You can't call back that temper tantrum. You can't call back that sorry demonstration that you put on before somebody else. That sorry way you behave. But what you can do when you realize that it's wrong and confessed it to God, trust God's good providence to do what's right, or else you'll stay in depression. You'll get depressed over your depression. You commit it to God's good providence. And then you can, in the midst of your struggles, you can say, God be exalted, as the psalmist did. Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let thy glory be above all the earth. Well, I trust this will be of some help to you, for somewhere along the line, I don't have to be a prophet to say this, that you are going to struggle with depression. And I want to encourage you to go to the Psalms. But remember the background. David is not writing these Psalms out of a vacuum. He's not sitting off in some seminary classroom composing these songs. He writes them in caves. He writes them in difficult places. And they're beautiful to study and to see in that background. You can identify with him in those Psalms. Let's divide up this evening and let's...